Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show that extracts the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from your stack of sources. I'm Chris Ruddy, your guide for today.
And I'm Sam Chandler, ready to help you navigate through the noise and get to the core of what truly matters.
Today, we're taking a truly in-depth look at Newsmax for September 2025. And this isn't about simply skimming headlines. We're going to dive deep into the most significant articles and topics within this issue.
That's right. We'll be thoroughly reporting on the core ideas, discussing their immediate impacts, and exploring the broader implications.
Our goal is really to ensure you walk away feeling truly well-informed, maybe with some surprising facts, and, you know, just enough humor to keep you hooked.
Exactly. Our mission is to distill the crucial facts, connect the dots in ways you might not expect, and explore the so what's for you, our curious listener.
So get ready to unpack the political shifts, the economic currents, the health revelations, and the cultural battleground shaping our world, all as seen through the lens of Newsmax this month.
We'll be your expert guides through this material, helping you understand what's most important and why it matters.
The political landscape and Trump administration initiatives.
Okay, kicking off our deep dive, we're heading straight into the political landscape, starting with some major Trump administration initiatives. Newsmax highlights a really significant move here. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is launching a massive $14 billion crackdown on healthcare fraud, waste, and duplication.
Wow, $14 billion. That's a big number.
It feels like a direct response to what they see as a pretty systemic issue.
It absolutely is. This initiative, and it's empowered by President Donald Trump's recently passed One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or OBBB, as they call it.
Right, the OBB.
It gives the administration specific tools to address what Newsmax describes as, well, rampant inefficiencies across Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP.
And the sheer scale of the problem they're targeting is quite revealing, isn't it?
It really is. For example, a review by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that's CMS.
CMS, got it.
They uncovered roughly 3 million people concurrently enrolled in multiple states or programs, which is, you know, a clear violation of federal rules.
3 million people. Double dipping, essentially.
Yeah.
That's just a staggering number.
It is. And Newsmax points out that this sort of systemic vulnerability was exposed partly because the Medicaid periodic data matching.
That's the system designed to catch this stuff.
Exactly. That very process was halted by the Biden administration during COVID-19 and apparently never reinstated.
Huh. So it sounds like a classic case of a policy-induced oversight gap, maybe, inadvertently allowing these abuses on a massive scale.
That's how Newsmax presents it. And the financial implications are enormous. Obamacare enrollment alone had swelled from 12 million to 24 million under the previous administration.
Doubled.
Doubled, driving federal spending from $57 billion to over $125 billion by the end of 2024.
Wow.
So you see figures like House Budget Committee Chair Jody Arrington praising Kennedy's announcement and criticizing what he called the enroll first, ask questions later approach of the past.
Okay, so what's the plan now?
Well, CMS Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz has outlined a plan to actively collaborate with states, not just to identify these dual enrollments, but to actually verify eligibility and offer individuals options.
Options like?
Like disenrolling from ineligible programs or adjusting their subsidies. The stated goal, according to the article, is to ensure no one loses necessary coverage, but, you know, unequivocally to eliminate those duplicate payments. This is framed as restoring fiscal responsibility.
And this commitment to fiscal responsibility, it extends to Medicaid itself, which Newsmax covers in another article titled How Trump Saved Medicaid.
Right.
The OBBB, which we just mentioned, it isn't just a collection of policies, it seems. Newsmax portrays it as representing the Trump administration's sweeping vision to systematically roll back what they see as federal overreach.
Redistributing power.
Yeah, redistributing power and fiscal responsibility towards states and maybe private sectors, from healthcare to family savings. For Medicaid, the goal is clearly stated. Curb the expansion of government-run healthcare, restrain spending, and refocus the program.
Refocus it back on its original purpose, covering the poor and disabled. And the background here is essential to understand.
Okay.
Medicaid, it's a federal-state partnership, right? Providing health insurance for low-income individuals, the disabled, covering nursing home care.
Right.
Historically, the federal matching funds, anywhere from 50% to 77%, they inherently incentivize states to spend more. It's just how the math works.
It makes sense.
But the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, significantly increased these federal matches, sometimes up to 100%, for states that expanded Medicaid. And that added some 20 million beneficiaries.
20 million more people.
Yeah. And then the continuous enrollment condition during COVID-19 further swelled the numbers. So today, Medicaid spends approximately $914 billion to cover over 70 million beneficiaries.
$900 billion. That's huge.
It's huge. And the issue, as Newsmax highlights it, is the massive scale of fraud and ineligible beneficiaries within this huge system.
That's where the numbers get truly alarming, according to the piece. The Office of Inspector General, the OIG.
Right, the OIG.
They previously reported nearly $1.4 billion in federal payments for over 700,000 ineligible beneficiaries. And that was just in four states between 2014 and 2015.
Just four states.
And then a staggering $5 billion for almost 5 million long-term ineligible beneficiaries.
5 million.
Yeah. Newsmax asserts here that Democrats generally haven't prioritized addressing this waste, fraud, and abuse in government health care.
Okay.
They cite examples like states supposedly gaming the system, like reclassifying patients as sicker to draw higher federal reimbursement.
Well, taxing hospitals and then returning the funds as higher Medicaid payments to inflate state spending and pull in more federal money. It creates this complex web of incentives and, well, potential abuses.
So the OBBB, the Act, aims to impose new restrictions to minimize these practices. And it includes a $50 billion hospital stabilization fund over 5 years, presumably to offset any losses.
Right. The overall goal is clearly to reduce the Medicaid population, slow spending growth, and return the program to its original focus. But the article wisely cautions that Republicans must remain vigilant.
Vigilant against what?
Against efforts by Democrats and bureaucrats to dilute these changes. They even draw parallels to the 1996 welfare reform. Right. It's presented as an ongoing effort, a battle, really, to reshape a massive government program.
Okay, so from the deep intricacies of healthcare reform, let's pivot a bit to the political chessboard.
Okay.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune is clearly playing a long game here. Newsmax reports he's unveiling a robust plan to boost the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate for the upcoming midterms.
And this strategy, Newsmax notes, builds directly on the recent passage of President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It's all connected.
It's a calculated move, it seems. But one key takeaway here, and Newsmax is quite candid about it, is the messaging challenge they face.
Oh.
A Wall Street Journal poll showed 54% of independents and a majority overall viewed Trump's signature legislation unfavorably. Opposition outweighs support by 10 points.
That reveals a real disconnect, doesn't it, between the policy itself and public perception.
Exactly. However, a CNN poll found that specific tax components within the bill were actually seen as a reason to support it.
Ah, so targeted messaging is crucial.
Precisely. So Thune's strategy involves an eight-figure, that's tens of millions, advertisement campaign by One Nation, an advocacy group linked to him.
Okay.
In six key states, focusing specifically on working family tax cuts. Highlighting the popular parts.
Makes sense. And the bill itself isn't just broad strokes, right?
Yeah.
It includes very tangible provisions.
Yeah. Things like a $1,000 tax-free savings account for children born between 2025 and 2028, measures to slow entitlement spending, and even a new tax maneuver that subsidizes private school tuition.
Interesting mix. And the financial muscle behind this push is also significant, according to the article.
Definitely. The National Republican Senatorial Committee apparently outraised its Democrat counterpart by about $8 million in the first half of the year.
And the Senate Leadership Fund
set a fundraising record for the first half of 2025, bringing in around $85 million. Huge numbers.
Wow.
And Thune is also collaborating directly with President Trump, the article says, to ensure electable candidates secure Republican nominations in key swing states.
So it underscores a unified party effort. It goes beyond just policy to candidate selection, fundraising, the whole package.
Exactly. Speaking of President Trump, he's not just focused on policy. He's literally leaving his mark on the White House structure itself.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Newsmax reports on his plans to initiate construction on a massive 90,000 square foot ballroom.
90,000 square feet. That's huge.
Projected to cost $200 million to replace the East Wing. And he intends for it to be funded by himself in private donations.
$200 million. Funded personally and by donations. That's quite a statement. You have to wonder about the motivation behind such a significant personal investment.
It's certainly bold. The practical justification, according to the president, as reported by Newsmax, is to host state banquets and large events.
Ah, so eliminating the need for those temporary tents on the South Lawn.
Exactly, which he stated become a disaster in rain or snow. Beyond this, other aesthetic and practical changes initiated by Trump since returning to office include installing towering flagpoles.
Okay.
And paving a grassy section of the Rose Garden, which he said addresses issues for women wearing high heels.
Right, so it's a blend of functionality and, well, personal taste that reflects his distinctive style.
Seems that way. And in an exclusive White House interview with Newsmax TV's Rob Finnerty, President Trump also offered a performance review of his cabinet and senior staff.
Oh, interesting. That provides a fascinating glimpse into his leadership style and priorities. It's always interesting to hear a leader's direct assessment of their team.
He certainly didn't hold back with praise, according to the report. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was praised as born for this job.
High praise.
A great debater, very smart, and a great guy, noting his near-unanimous Senate confirmation with 100 votes. That's pretty rare.
Very rare. Who else?
Education Secretary Linda McMahon was described as great and surprising, specifically for bringing education back to the states, which highlights a clear shift in federal education policy.
Okay, decentralization focus there.
Energy Secretary Chris Wright was lauded as one of the most successful people in the entire world of energy, having great expertise.
And the praise continued across the board, it seems.
Pretty much. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was commended for his soothing way and being very highly respected. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem received accolades for a fantastic job, especially on border security, mentioning her collaboration with Tom Homan.
Right.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., we mentioned him earlier, characterized as one of the most popular people with a clear objective to make America healthy again, focusing on childhood diseases.
Okay.
Even White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt was called a star and amazing for her communication style.
So these ratings provide real insight into the qualities the president values in his administration. Competence, loyalty, public image.
It seems so. And it's also worth noting, in the same interview, Trump reiterated his belief that former President Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton should pay a price for their alleged roles in the Russiagate hoax.
Ah, which sets the stage perfectly for our next major topic.
It certainly does. That brings us directly to a persistent and, let's face it, highly contentious issue that Newsmax covers extensively.
Yeah.
The Russiagate hoax and the rule of law.
This is a big one.
Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard has released hundreds of pages of declassified documents, and she's making some pretty definitive assertions based on them.
What's she claiming?
She claims these documents prove that allegations of President Trump colluding with Russia in 2016 were false.
Okay.
That the Obama administration knew they were false,
mm-hmm.
and that directives to disseminate these accusations originated from the highest levels of the Obama White House.
That's a profound claim. And the alleged evidence Newsmax presents is stark.
How so?
Newsmax states the Obama-era FBI presented false information to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA court.
The FISA court, right.
To illegally obtain warrants to spy on Trump's 2016 campaign. They reportedly lied to both the FISA court and Congress.
And there's more.
Furthermore, Hillary Clinton's campaign is accused of funding the infamous dossier of alleged lies about Trump, which apparently partly formed the basis for those surveillance warrants and a pervasive media campaign.
Steele dossier.
Exactly. And emails between former FBI employees Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, who were involved in the investigation, are cited as suggesting an insurance policy to prevent Trump's election.
An insurance policy. That phrase became pretty well known.
It did. And of course, the subsequent Mueller investigation found no evidence of collusion and cost American taxpayers $32 million.
And what's particularly striking, according to Newsmax, is the perceived lack of significant accountability for all this.
How so?
Well, the Democratic National Committee and Clinton's campaign received relatively minor fines, like $105,000 and $8,000, for violating federal election commission rules.
Seems small compared to the scale of the allegations.
Right. The FBI apparently received a stern rebuke. And perhaps most surprisingly, Strzok and Page, despite their involvement, sued the government.
They sued.
And received a $2 million settlement from the Justice Department.
$2 million? Wow. That does raise a crucial question about how justice is applied, especially to those in positions of power.
But the most explosive revelation from Gabbard, according to the Newsmax report, is the claim about Russian intelligence.
What's the claim there?
That Russian intelligence possessed damaging information, not about Trump, but about Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Damaging information like what?
Allegedly, including details about her serious physical and mental health issues and her dependence upon tranquilizers.
So the implication is Russia had leverage or compromat over Clinton, not Trump.
That's the implication Newsmax draws. And yet, the article claims the Obama administration allegedly used this knowledge to craft a false narrative, projecting Clinton's own vulnerabilities onto Trump.
Wow. If that's accurate, it completely recontextualizes the entire collusion narrative, doesn't it?
It certainly does, according to this report. This alleged conspiracy, rather than the fake pearl clutching from the left, is what Newsmax argues represents the real threat to America's Republican form of government.
That's a strong statement.
The article stresses the importance of the equal application of laws to everyone, especially the famous, powerful, wealthy, and well-connected. It warns that a loss of public belief in the rule of law could lead to the evolution of, well, alternative systems.
It's a powerful argument about the very foundations of American governance and trust in institutions.
Societal shifts and ideological battlegrounds.
Okay, moving beyond the immediate political landscape now, let's talk about something that's rapidly reshaping our daily lives. Artificial intelligence.
AI. Yeah.
Everywhere now. Newsmax dives deep into this with an article titled, AI's Left-Wing Bias Worse Than You Think. It suggests that Elon Musk's long-standing warnings
about AI becoming woke.
Exactly, becoming woke and politically correct because it's trained on left-leaning sources.
Yeah.
Well, these warnings are reportedly being confirmed by recent studies.
This is such a critical area for understanding how information is shaped and consumed today. An Axios study in July found that leading AI models like ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, they heavily rely on sources like Wikipedia and other progressive outlets.
So the inputs are biased.
That's the argument. Bradley Smith, former Federal Election Commission chair, expressed concern that this poses a built-in and clear threat to how AI selects and shapes information.
And there are other studies.
Yeah, data scientist David Rosato studied 24 models, and apparently all but one exhibited a clear left-leaning bias on key political questions: immigration, climate policy, civil rights. Stanford's Hoover Institution also found major AI models consistently give liberal-leaning answers.
So it's not just one study showing this.
Seems to be a pattern they're identifying. And the practical examples Newsmax gives are quite telling.
Like what?
When Newsmax directly asked ChatGPT which news sources it trusts most, the AI listed only left-leaning outlets: the New York Times, the Washington Post, Reuters, AP, NPR, the BBC.
With a notable absence of any conservative viewpoint.
Exactly. The article also points out that ChatGPT uses NewsGuard.
I've heard of NewsGuard.
Yeah, described by legal expert Jonathan Turley as a massive censorship system. ChatGPT apparently uses it to filter and rate news trustworthiness, further embedding this alleged bias.
So it makes you wonder how much information is being filtered before it even reaches the user, right?
That's the concern. And the deeper insight here isn't just the, you know, billions of words AI models are trained on, but how that process itself is influenced.
Oh, so.
Donald Kendall of the Heartland Institute attributes this to several factors. One, programmers tend to be younger and politically left-leaning.
Okay.
Two, many tech companies overtly embrace diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. This essentially acts as a second layer of ideological curation, shaping AI outputs even before the algorithms process the data.
Can you give an example?
Well, a stark example cited is Google Gemini's image generator, controversially depicting white historical figures, including, reportedly, Nazis and Vikings, as black. It highlights how these biases can manifest in really unexpected and sometimes problematic ways.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, and, well, for the future of AI?
Newsmax suggests we might be seeing a pendulum swing towards more open discourse, citing the Trump administration's efforts post what they call Biden-era censorship.
And Musk's response.
Elon Musk himself responded to this issue by creating xAI and Grok, designed to be a maximum truth-seeking AI, though even early tests apparently still showed some left-leaning bias.
So it's hard to eliminate completely.
Seems very difficult. Mark Zuckerberg has also acknowledged government pressure and ejected Facebook's practices. The key takeaway, according to Bradley Smith and Donald Kendall in the article, is for consumers, for you, to recognize that all AI systems have biases and to actively seek a variety of perspectives. Don't just take the first answer.
Good advice. And President Trump apparently issued an executive order targeting woke AI in July 2025.
That's what Newsmax reports. It's a clear call for critical engagement with this powerful technology.
And this concern about bias, it's really just one facet of a much larger conversation around AI, isn't it? which leads to the next Newsmax article, AI's threat to humanity.
Yeah, the bigger picture stuff. While Nobel committees recognize the dramatic progress of AI in modeling human intuition, boosting productivity, this rapid advancement carries significant risks, short-term and potential long-term risks.
Risks we need to address seriously.
Absolutely. The immediate risks are already palpable, the article argues. AI creating divisive echo chambers, feeding people content designed to make them indignant, which exacerbates societal polarization.
And surveillance.
Yes, being used by authoritarian governments for mass surveillance and by cyber criminals for increasingly sophisticated phishing attacks.
And looking just a little further down the road,
there's the terrifying prospect outlined in the article of AI being used to develop deadly new viruses or autonomous lethal weapons capable of deciding who to kill or maim. These are not distant sci-fi scenarios anymore. They're seen as being on our horizon.
That's unsettling.
It compels us to ask an important, maybe even existential question articulated by AI pioneer Geoffrey Hinton.
What does he say?
He warns that the possibility of AI becoming significantly smarter than humans and taking control away from us is very likely. He places the probability somewhere between 1% and 99%.
1 to 99%. That's a huge range, but the upper end is terrifying.
It is. He uses this powerful analogy of a cute tiger cub that might grow up to kill you.
Oh, okay.
Emphasizing that if AI development remains primarily profit-driven, human safety simply won't be the top priority. It's a stark warning about the potential consequences of unchecked technological advancement, a fundamental challenge to our future.
But despite these grave concerns, Hinton also sees significant potential for AI to profoundly improve the human experience, right?
He does. He points to areas like healthcare, drug development, education, fields where AI could bring revolutionary benefits, transforming lives for the better.
So it's a reminder that while the risks are real and demand vigilance, the potential for positive impact is equally immense, if guided ethically and responsibly.
That seems to be the crux of it.
Okay, shifting gears slightly, but staying within this realm of ideological battlegrounds, the Newsmax issue presents a provocative perspective in an article titled Pagan Threat to America, Woke Ideology Leads to Paganism.
That's quite a title.
It is. Pastor Lucas Miles, in his book Pagan Threat, argues that woke ideology isn't merely a cultural shift, but actually a precursor to a resurgence of paganism.
A resurgence of paganism. How does he connect those?
He contends that Marxism, which he says has historically tried to parasite onto Christianity, has found a new, more compatible host in pagan practices.
Why more compatible?
Because, he argues, Christianity's foundational morals provide critical guardrails against a Marxist ideological takeover, whereas paganism doesn't necessarily have those same constraints.
That's a strong and deeply interpretive assertion, suggesting a kind of spiritual dimension to current cultural debates.
Exactly. Miles describes contemporary paganism as vastly different from its historical forms. He says it now blends sexual identity, Marxist ideology, and an anti-Christian spirituality.
And who does he think this appeals to?
He believes this blend is increasingly appealing to younger populations, particularly women, who tend to be more progressive, and platforms like Instagram and TikTok are identified as major highways for its spread.
Any example?
The article mentions things like a golf witch promising to improve scores for a fee. It paints a picture of a broad, pervasive, and maybe surprisingly diverse cultural shift, at least from his perspective.
So what are the implications, according to Miles?
He argues this neo-pagan worldview is challenging and twisting traditional Christian perspectives on sexuality, marriage, abortion, and he fears the Western world is unprepared for the consequences.
And his advice for Christians?
He recommends building a stronger digital presence and churches helping members establish a primary doctrine to prevent them from being easily led astray. It's essentially a call for spiritual self-defense in the face of what he perceives as a profound ideological threat.
And the article takes this analysis even further, doesn't it? Framing wokeism itself.
Yeah, as a religion in all but name, complete with its own sacred texts, high priests, and rituals of penance and purification.
So not just a cultural trend, but something darker.
It's presented as a deliberate and dark movement towards occult practices, inherently anti-Christian.
Yeah.
Concepts like identity politics, intersectionality, radical inclusivity, these are presented as being rooted in ancient pagan ideologies.
And cancel culture.
Portrayed as a modern-day Inquisition, imposing forced spiritual conversion through public shaming and ostracization, excommunicating those who refuse to conform. Very strong language.
Wow. And who does Newsmax say is behind this?
The article outlines an alliance waging this spiritual warfare. It's quite a list. Marxists, radical environmentalists, technocratic scientists, LGBTQ plus activists, racial justice activists, eugenicists, witches, traditional pagans, neo-pagans, and theosophical elites.
That's a broad coalition.
It is. And this collective influence is alleged to have infiltrated major nonprofits, entertainment agencies, research labs, religious institutions, educational centers, government agencies, successfully shifting global spiritual consciousness away from Christianity. It's a comprehensive and frankly pretty stark view of current societal and ideological conflicts as presented in the magazine.
Definitely a unique perspective on current events.
Okay, moving from these spiritual and cultural battlegrounds to the political geography of the nation, the Newsmax issue includes an article provocatively titled, Democrats Want Out.
Secession. From Democrats.
Historically, yes, secession movements have been associated with conservative strongholds, but this article highlights that they're now gaining significant traction among Democrats, particularly in blue states.
Why now?
Apparently, many are increasingly open to considering a national breakup following Donald Trump's return to the presidency and a Republican-controlled Congress.
Is there polling data on this?
Yes. A 2025 YouGov poll revealed that 47% of West Coast Democrats and 39% of Northeastern Democrats express at least some support for secession. That's a sharp increase from just 6% in 2021.
47% on the West Coast. That's almost half.
And overall, about 40% of Joe Biden voters have considered a national breakup. It suggests a widespread, though ideologically diverse, frustration with national unity.
Any specific examples?
California is particularly prominent. 44% of residents reportedly support a ballot measure for peaceful secession. The Yes California Independence Committee is actively gathering signatures for a 2026 ballot initiative.
And their reasoning.
Founder Marcus Ruiz Evans states that California values are totally different from American values, citing issues like immigration and LGBTQ plus policies as points of disillusionment.
Is there an economic angle too?
There is. The article points out California contributes substantially more in federal taxes than it receives in federal spending, a negative balance of about $83 billion in 2022. That economic argument often underpins secessionist sentiments.
But what about the legality? Can states just leave?
Well, that's the huge hurdle. The Supreme Court's 1869 ruling in Texas v. White established that states cannot unilaterally secede without approval from other states or a constitutional amendment.
So legally almost impossible.
Pretty much. Professor Ryan D. Griffith notes that secession typically succeeds only in very specific circumstances involving unique, regionally concentrated populations with clear divisions. So while the sentiment might be growing, the practical path is incredibly difficult.
Okay. And this ties into another trend, right? Moving van economics.
Exactly. Another fascinating Newsmax article highlighting a significant demographic and cultural shift. Millions of Americans are literally voting with their feet, relocating across state lines.
Where are they going?
The migration sees residents and capital flowing out of what the article calls deep blue liberal states, burdened by high taxes and regulation, and into deep red conservative states with more favorable economic policies.
Is the scale significant?
It's truly reshaping the map. A quarter century ago, in 2000, New York and California had a combined population of 52.9 million, way more than Texas, and Florida's 36.9 million.
And now?
Today, NY and CA stand at 59.7 million, just slightly above TX and FL's 56 million. The gap has almost closed. Stephen Moore of Unleash Prosperity states the Southeast is now the dominant production powerhouse over the Northeast.
And specific numbers on people moving.
From 2012 to 2022, California alone lost nearly 70,000 residents and $12 billion in personal income to Florida, and a staggering 360,000 residents and $21 billion to Texas.
And the tax connection.
An interesting point Newsmax makes is that all these major recipient states, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, have no personal income tax. Stark contrast to California's progressive levy that goes up to 13.3%.
So taxes seem to be a major driver.
It appears so. This is more than just people moving. It's described as a virtuous circle by Virginia Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin.
How does that work?
Growing states experience budget surpluses, which then enable tax cuts, which attracts further inbound migration and investment. Virginia, for example, moved from 40th to 9th in state growth under this model, according to the article.
So policy directly influences demographic and economic vitality.
That's the argument. Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform predicts a majority of the country will soon live in zero or flat tax states. He even suggests a national flat tax could turbocharge the U.S. economy. This voting with your feet phenomenon is fundamentally reshaping the economic and political landscape.
Fascinating trend.
Now, as millions of Americans vote with their feet, reshaping our urban landscapes, we're also seeing new, maybe unexpected challenges emerge within cities.
Yeah.
And none more literally skyrocketing than the alarming surge in e-bike accidents. Right. A JAMA surgery report highlights a staggering 30-fold jump in e-bike-related injuries in the U.S. between 2017 and 2022.
30 times. That's incredible.
I have to admit, I saw someone on one of these zooming down a bike lane the other day, completely helmetless texting, almost took out a lamppost. It's a vivid reminder of how quickly this technology has outpaced our safety regulations, you know.
That's a relatable anecdote, and it perfectly illustrates the severity Newsmax reports. Injuries to children rose sharply, accounting for 13% of all cases.
13% are kids.
Yeah. And e-bike head trauma specifically increased 49 times. From just 163 cases in 2017 to nearly 8,000 by 2022.
49 times. That's unbelievable.
Dr. Brian Waterman of Wake Forest University School of Medicine notes that e-bike injuries often resemble vehicle accident injuries because of the speeds involved, over 20 miles per hour, with very little muscle power needed.
Right.
And the trend dramatically accelerated post-COVID-19 lockdowns. While industry advocates might blame lack of safety training or distracted motorists, the sight of helmetless e-bikers weaving through traffic and sidewalks is a common urban reality, exacerbating these risks.
And beyond the trauma from collisions, there's another serious concern, right? Fires.
Yes, a significant and often deadly concern is the link between e-bikes and fires, especially in densely populated urban centers. The primary culprit identified is substandard uncertified batteries that can overheat or explode.
Are there examples?
The article cites a tragic example from July where a 76-year-old woman in Queens died due to an exploding e-bike lithium-ion battery.
Oh, terrible.
In New York City, in particular, saw an almost 800% increase in e-mobility battery fires between 2019 and 2023.
800%.
Causing over $500 million in damage. Mayor Eric Adams has expressed grave concern over unsafe, uncertified batteries. It's led some apartment towers to ban e-bikes indoors.
Which forces storage and charging outside, increasing theft risk, I imagine.
Exactly. It's a complex problem.
So what's being done?
This multifaceted problem demands comprehensive responses. Cities and counties nationwide are implementing regulations, helmet laws, battery regulations, age requirements. A New York Post video of an e-biker hitting a 3-year-old in Brooklyn really underscored the urgent dangers.
But enforcement must be difficult.
Enforcement remains a significant challenge. E-bikers often aren't required to have driver's licenses, right? So ticket penalties are less effective in deterring unsafe behavior.
Right.
Federal law limits e-bike power to 750 watts, allowing them in bike lanes, but their rapid acceleration can surprise pedestrians. The article mentions a retired NYPD chaplain who suffered a broken leg from an e-bike collision. The larger question really is how urban infrastructure and policy adapt to these rapidly evolving micromobility options. It's a moving target.
Legal, regulatory, and international development.
Okay, moving into legal and regulatory developments now.
Yeah.
A surprising headline in Newsmax catches the eye. Harvard may pay $500 to settle Trump charges.
$500 million. For what?
Harvard University is reportedly considering this hefty settlement to resolve charges of anti-Semitism and issues related to its diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI policy.
DEI policies, okay.
These charges were brought forth by the Trump administration, and this potential settlement would be more than double the $200 million Columbia University agreed to pay for similar charges back in July.
Wow, more than double Columbia's. That's a crucial distinction, isn't it? It highlights maybe a strategic approach to these cases.
Seems like it. Harvard, which initially vowed to fight the administration, is now, according to reports, open to a deal.
And the administration's stance?
President Trump is reportedly intent on making Harvard pay more than Columbia, suggesting a strong federal push. An earlier offer of $250 million was apparently rejected by Harvard, indicating some tough negotiations are happening.
What leverage does the administration have?
Well, they accused Harvard of being a hotbed of anti-Semitism and, significantly, threatened to revoke the university's ability to host foreign students. That would be a massive blow to any major academic institution.
Absolutely. And this isn't just Harvard, right? It's part of a broader context.
Exactly. The University of Michigan is also under federal scrutiny following charges against two Chinese scientists for smuggling biological materials. That prompted an Education Department investigation into foreign funding and national security vulnerabilities tied to China.
So, a focus on foreign influence.
President Trump has clearly prioritized increasing transparency around foreign gifts and contracts to U.S. universities. Similar investigations were opened at other prestigious institutions like Harvard, Penn, UC Berkeley. It really highlights a strong federal push to assert control over academic institutions on issues of national security and maybe cultural policy, too, aiming to curb foreign influence.
Okay, shifting to media now. Newsmax itself is actively fighting a bid to lift the broadcast ownership cap.
Right, the article Newsmax Fights Bid to Lift Media Ownership Cap describes this cap as a critical regulatory firewall.
What does the cap do?
It currently restricts any single broadcaster from reaching more than 39% of U.S. television households. The idea is to prevent nationwide media monopolies.
It's interesting to see Newsmax, often critical of federal overreach, defending a regulation here.
It is, but they frame it as a crucial defense of media diversity. Major broadcast conglomerates, many with liberal-leaning news divisions, according to Newsmax, are actively lobbying to raise or eliminate this cap.
And Newsmax sees this
as dangerous. Arguing it conflicts with Congress's original intent to prevent media conglomerates from dominating local markets. They contend weakening of the cap would harm media diversity, diminish local news coverage, and consolidate political power over information.
The local news angle is significant.
They specifically point out that allowing networks like CBS, ABC, and NBC to acquire more stations would give them less incentive to produce local programming, impacting the 16 million Americans who apparently rely on it nightly.
There's also a competitive angle for Newsmax itself, right?
Yes. A key takeaway here is their concern that allowing Fox Corporation to acquire more stations would increase its leverage to restrict Newsmax from reaching more U.S. households. They cite News Nation's struggles compared to Newsmax's higher viewership as an example of these dynamics.
So what's the history of this cap?
Historically, the cap was first adopted under President Reagan's FCC in the 80s. It was codified into federal law in 2004, which, according to Newsmax, removed the FCC's discretion to change it.
So legally, they argue the FCC can't touch it.
Exactly. Newsmax argues the FCC lacks the authority to modify a cap explicitly set by Congress, citing the Supreme Court's major questions doctrine. This signals a significant legal and political battle over the future of media ownership.
And they draw parallels to the radio industry.
Yes, powerful parallels. After the 1996 Telecommunications Act allowed massive consolidation in radio, the result was unsustainable debt for major players like iHeartMedia and the gutting of local programming in favor of syndicated national content.
A cautionary tale.
Newsmax warns that similar debt-driven acquisition sprees are already playing out in TV broadcasting, and weakening the cap would only accelerate this trend, further eroding local news and media diversity.
Okay, on a different front, but still related to strategic resources, the U.S. is boosting its rare earth mine capabilities.
Ah, yes. The article U.S. Boots Rare Earth Mine. It reports that MP Materials, which operates the only American rare earth mine.
The only one.
Apparently. They've secured a new $500 million agreement with Apple.
Apple? For what?
To produce powerful magnets for iPhones and other high-tech products, like electric vehicles.
That sounds like a significant step towards national resource independence, doesn't it?
It does, and the government is clearly involved in this strategic push. The Defense Department has also agreed to purchase rare earth materials from MP Materials for military applications.
And GM, too.
Yes, complemented by General Motors' plan to use MP Materials for its electric vehicles later this year. It seems like a cohesive national effort.
What truly stands out here, though, is the broader significance of these agreements. They signal a strategic boost to domestic rare earth production.
Aiming to reduce reliance on foreign sources.
Particularly China, for these critical materials. These rare earths are absolutely essential for both commercial technology and national defense. So securing a domestic supply chain is presented as a key move for national security and economic resilience in an increasingly competitive global landscape.
Makes sense.
Oh.
Turning our attention now to national security proper, President Donald Trump's proposal to build a $175 billion Golden Dome missile defense system.
The Golden Dome, right.
It certainly faced its share of criticism, with some calling it wasteful. However, the Newsmax article, Golden Dome a No-Brainer, highlights experts like William R. Forshin.
He's an expert in EMP weapons, right? Electromagnetic pulse.
Exactly. And he strongly defends its necessity, calling it long overdue.
How does he rebut the critics?
His rebuttal is quite direct. He dismisses the claim that the system would require nearly 10,000 orbiting intercept rockets as absurd.
Absurd. What does he suggest?
He suggests 20 or 30 satellites would suffice. He clarifies that the Golden Dome isn't primarily for a massive nuclear strike from major powers like Russia or China.
So what's it for then?
He says it's rather to defend against third world players and rogue crazies capable of launching just a few missiles, which it could easily shoot down.
And Trump's vision for it.
Trump envisions the Golden Dome deploying next-generation technologies across the land, sea, and space, including space-based sensors and interceptors.
Yeah.
The ambitious goal is apparently being operational by the end of his term, capable of intercepting missiles launched from anywhere, including space.
That's ambitious. And Forshin emphasizes the urgency.
He really does. He states the U.S. is woefully late in building such a system, having been, in his words, running naked for the last 40 years with outdated technology.
And he points to Israel's Iron Dome.
As a successful, proven model, yeah. Suggesting the Golden Dome would be an even more advanced version, while the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, estimates range widely for such systems.
Depending on the threat level.
Right. Forshin argues the cost is almost irrelevant. He views it as an essential insurance policy for America's $100 trillion infrastructure.
An insurance policy against what? Primarily EMP.
That's presented as the primary justification, protection against an EMP attack. Such an attack involving a nuclear detonation about 200 miles up.
Would create a gamma ray burst.
Right. That could fry the nation's electrical grid through the Compton effect, high energy gamma rays knocking electrons free, creating a massive surge.
And the potential consequences.
Forshin warns a worst-case scenario of three such weapons detonated over the U.S. could lead to millions perishing due to the collapse of electricity, water systems, supply lines for food, pharmaceuticals, a total societal breakdown.
So beyond the Golden Dome, what else is needed?
Forshin stresses the critical need to upgrade the U.S.'s 40-year-old electrical grid, estimated at $50-100 billion. And he advocates for components to be manufactured domestically, not in China.
Has Congress acted on this?
According to the article, Congress has already approved the first $25 billion of Trump's request in the OBB and established a Golden Dome caucus, signaling some bipartisan support for this critical infrastructure push.
Okay. Shifting to international relations now. A significant development is highlighted in the article, UK and France sign key nuclear deal.
What's the deal?
In July, French President Emmanuel Macron and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer held a summit, culminating in an agreement to coordinate their nuclear arsenals.
Coordinate, not share.
That's a key distinction. And the move is clearly driven by the perceived erosion of America's credibility as a nuclear ally under President Trump and the ongoing Russian war in Ukraine. It signals a major shift in European defense strategy.
So it emphasizes coordination, not sharing, because France wants to maintain control.
Exactly. France historically maintains control over its independent nuclear arsenal. John Bolton suggests Macron aims to deflect EU demands for France to surrender its nuclear weapons.
And for the UK, Starmer.
He faces the challenge of strengthening ties with Europe while trying to preserve the UK's special relationship with the US, upon which its own nuclear deterrent depends. It's a delicate balance.
The article also suggests this serves as a political life raft for both leaders.
Yes, both are facing low approval ratings, economic stagnation, soaring debt, political pressure from illegal migration. So it's a complex dance of geopolitics and domestic concerns.
But how effective can this coordination truly be? Their arsenals are much smaller than Russia's, right?
Dramatically smaller. France and Britain have maybe 500 nuclear weapons combined compared to Russia's estimated 5,000. This makes their combined force an unlikely substitute for U.S. protection without massive increases in defense spending.
So some experts are skeptical.
Yes, some fear it could even be a coalition of the weak. Eric S. Edelman, a former Undersecretary of Defense, warns that hyping this agreement could inadvertently strengthen the hand of VP J.D. Vance and others in the Trump administration who advocate for withdrawing the 100,000 U.S. troops from Europe.
So potential unintended consequences. Is this deal part of a broader European effort?
It seems so. It follows French treaties with Poland and Sweden and a new defense treaty between Germany and the U.K. European NATO members have agreed to increase defense spending to 5% of GDP, though modernization costs could total $117 billion.
But obstacles remain.
Strategic differences persist. Britain's arsenal is submarine only. Developing an aviation platform would be costly. And past Anglo-French treaties have often been hampered by industrial rivalry, suggesting coordination is a complex undertaking.
Did they discuss anything else? Migration?
Yes, beyond nuclear matters, the leaders also agreed on a mechanism for the return of illegal migrants to France in exchange for UK acceptance of vetted applicants, addressing record channel crossings.
And a cultural gesture, too.
Yes, Macron agreed to lend the historic Bayeux Tapestry to Britain to foster cultural exchange. It really highlights the multifaceted nature of international diplomacy, lending high-stakes defense with cultural soft power.
Health and wellness insights.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to our health and wellness. The September Newsmax issue offers some really timely advice, starting with your fall reboot.
A fall reboot sounds nice.
Fall is beautifully presented as nature's soft reboot, an ideal time to reset your body and mind after the, you know, disruptions of summer, and to truly prepare for the demands of the cooler months ahead.
It's a practical and holistic approach, and the article provides a wealth of expert tips for resetting your health. One key area is mental health.
Oh, so?
Embracing introspection and reflection. Maybe starting with short meditation sessions, even 3 minutes, using apps or just silent breathing, gradually increasing it.
Simple starts. What else?
Another crucial tip is rebuilding routine. Establishing consistent morning and evening habits to anchor the day and counteract summer's disrupted schedules. These bookend habits, they call them, create essential stability.
That makes sense. Physical health.
Prioritizing physical health, of course. Setting minimum and maximum daily movement goals. Even on low energy days, a quick walk or gentle yoga session counts as a win.
Triggering dopamine, reinforcing consistency.
Exactly. And diet-wise, focus on fiber. Recognize fiber as a superfood, vital for balancing hormones, stabilizing blood sugar, supporting gut health. Aim for half of each meal to be vegetables, fruits, beans, or whole grains.
Practical advice. And setting boundaries.
Huge. Prioritize you. Learn to say no to commitments to prevent burnout, feeling like you're wearing thin. Clean your home. Declutter one space each weekend. A tidy space positively impacts the brain, apparently.
Shedding emotions, too. What does that mean?
Unplugging from doom scrolling. Limiting exposure to content that dysregulates your nervous system. Replacing these with grounding rituals, movement, or journaling. Recognizing social and emotional health are just as important as physical.
So creating boundaries extends to work-life balance, screen time.
Absolutely. Set clear boundaries between work and personal time. Protect your energy from draining individuals. Limit screen time.
And the diet advice, again, small changes.
Yeah, focus on manageable, small nutritional changes, like adding one extra fruit or vegetable to each meal. Aiming for meals that don't cause that post-meal fatigue. Meal prepping on Sundays is highly recommended.
Finally, checking in with yourself.
Practicing mindfulness by savoring simple joys, walking in crunchy leaves, enjoying coffee. Rekindling relationships or joining community groups to boost connection, which is identified as a vital part of overall wellness. These are actionable steps anyone can take, emphasizing small, consistent changes for bigger impact.
Good stuff. Moving to a more urgent aspect of health, Newsmax has an article titled, Stay Out of Emergency Room.
Important advice.
While ERs are absolutely essential for critical situations, the piece emphasizes that many common ailments can and probably should be handled elsewhere. It underscores proactive care and knowing when to seek the right level of medical attention.
Trying to avoid unnecessary emergency visits makes sense for everyone, patients, and the system.
This is incredibly practical advice. For minor injuries, think sprains, colds, minor burns, maybe mild allergic reactions. Urgent care facilities are typically more appropriate and often more cost-effective than the ER.
So do your homework beforehand.
That's the recommendation. Research local urgent care facilities in advance so you know their capabilities. Do they have imaging? Can they do simple procedures? Knowing this before you actually need them can save a lot of time and stress.
But the article is clear about when the ER is necessary, right?
Absolutely. It provides a clear delineation. The ER is the best choice for suspected heart attacks.
Symptoms like chest pain, dizziness, lightheadedness.
Right. Or for strokes, with signs like droopy eyes or a sagging face. Or for sepsis, high fever, high heart rate, trouble breathing.
These are time-sensitive conditions requiring immediate treatment.
Exactly. Stroke treatment within 3 hours, cardiac catheterization within 90 minutes for heart attacks. Delaying in these cases can be life-threatening.
Any special considerations for older adults?
Yes. The article notes older adults often require special attention. Falls, particularly for those on blood thinners or with head injuries, necessitate an entire trauma team due to high risks of internal bleeding or broken ribs.
And prevention.
Proactive measures are key. Knowing your medical conditions, adhering to medication regimens, listening to your body. plus basic safety seat belts, airbags, helmets for bikes and scooters. Critical preventive steps.
Okay.
Another interesting piece of research in the health section is about exercise timing, titled Best Time of Day to Exercise.
The age-old question, is there a best time?
Well, new research from the University of Florida, sponsored by the National Institute on Aging, NIA, suggests that the timing and consistency of exercise can significantly impact heart health.
How so?
Specifically, it can improve cardiorespiratory fitness and walking efficiency, both key indicators of healthy aging.
Tell me about the study.
It involved 76 participants, average age 76. Their activity was monitored for 7 days using wrist devices, and they also underwent cardiopulmonary exercise testing to assess heart and lung function.
And the findings, did say when is best?
The core message isn't necessarily a single best time for everyone, but it emphasizes that when and how consistently you exercise does make a difference for long-term cardiovascular health.
Mm.
The research provides a definitive answer that timing matters.
So it prompts individuals to consider optimizing their exercise schedules, maybe finding a consistent time that works for them. A nuanced but important point.
Exactly. Now, let's delve into some specific health conditions and treatments mentioned in Newsmax, starting with prostate cancer after age 70.
Okay.
This article highlights that prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American men. But critically, most men survive it due to its typically slow growth. Still causes about 34,000 deaths annually, though.
And the dilemma is around screening.
Yeah.
Right? Especially for older men.
Precisely. Early stages often present no symptoms, making screening crucial. The PSA blood test has been the standard since 86. Yet, there are growing concerns about overdiagnosis and overtreatment if biopsies are performed on everyone with an elevated PSA.
Because the harms of treatment can outweigh the benefits for low-risk disease.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, why stop testing after 70? Medical guidelines generally recommend this because studies indicate biopsies and treatments in this age group may pose more dangers than simply living with the cancer.
What kind of dangers?
Complications from biopsies include bleeding, infection, urinary retention. Treatments like radiation and surgery carry high rates of erectile dysfunction and incontinence, given that 98% of men with prostate cancer are still alive after 10 years.
The risks often outweigh the benefits for those with a limited life expectancy.
That's the rationale presented. The article references former President Joe Biden's stage 4 prostate cancer diagnosis at age 82 as an example of doctors following these guidelines.
So the recommendation is?
Men over 70 should have a detailed discussion with a urologist regarding PSA testing. Consider individual age, symptoms, overall health. It's a very personalized approach, prioritizing quality of life.
Makes sense. Next up, the article, These Foods Can Reduce Chronic Pain, offers valuable insights. Chronic pain affects over 1 in 5 Americans.
That's a lot of people.
And diet plays a significant role in managing it. Excess body weight contributes to joint stress, and abdominal fat generates inflammation, both strongly linked to pain.
So there's a powerful connection between what we eat and how we feel, especially with pain.
Definitely. The article highlights that simply losing weight can alleviate pain. New research from the University of South Australia found that a diet rich in vegetables, fruits, and unprocessed foods significantly reduces chronic pain in overweight or obese women. Remarkably, even without weight loss.
Really? Even without weight loss?
For women in that study, yes. However, for men, it appears losing weight alongside a healthy diet is likely necessary for meaningful relief.
Interesting gender difference there. What specific dietary recommendations does it make?
Incorporating anti-inflammatory omega-3 fats is key, from salmon and other oily fish like mackerel, herring, sardines, several times a week, or taking a daily fish oil supplement, 2,600 milligrams or more of omega-3s.
And that helps with conditions like
osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis, specifically mentioned. Other beneficial foods include whole grains like oats and quinoa, beans and lentils for fiber and antioxidants, colorful fruits and vegetables, olive oil, and adequate water intake.
And foods to avoid.
Processed foods, fried foods, sugary drinks, red meats, processed meats, the usual suspects for inflammation. Anti-inflammatory spices like clove, ginger, rosemary, turmeric, sage, cumin can also help. Turmeric and ginger are often cited for inflammation.
Yes, a University of Florida study found these reduced chronic inflammation. This is a powerful reminder that our kitchen can be a pharmacy, right? Making intentional dietary choices can profoundly impact daily comfort.
Absolutely. Connecting diet to long-term health. The article, Healthy Diet in Midlife Linked to Healthy Aging, presents compelling evidence.
What's the link?
A healthy diet maintained through midlife-rich and plant-based foods, low-to-moderate animal-based foods, minimal ultra-processed foods, is strongly linked to a higher probability of reaching age 70 free of major chronic diseases, while also preserving cognitive, physical, and mental health.
Is there a study backing this?
A big one. A Nature Medicine study followed 105,000 individuals for 30 years. It found an 86% greater likelihood of healthy aging with such a diet.
86% greater likelihood. That's significant. Does weight loss in midlife matter too?
It does. A University of Helsinki study showed overweight men and women who lost an average of 6.5% of their body weight in early middle age and sustained it lived longer, healthier lives.
And stress.
Stress is a factor. High levels of the stress hormone cortisol in midlife are associated with increased amyloid proteins in the brain linked to Alzheimer's disease. Postmenopausal hormone changes might amplify cortisol's effects.
What about social factors?
Fascinating connections there, too. Active participation in social activities for those age 60 and older, charity work, grandkids, sports clubs, is linked to living longer, with a 42% lower risk of death.
Social connection is key.
Conversely, living with two or more chronic conditions, like heart disease plus diabetes, can more than double the risk of depression. It all underscores the interconnectedness of our health, diet, stress, social life.
Even oral health.
Yes. Poor oral health is linked to migraines and body pain in women, according to a University of Sydney study cited. It's all connected.
Okay, turning to targeted treatments now. Newsmax features vitamin supplement slows glaucoma.
Glaucoma. Okay, what's the finding?
Research at Karolinska Institute found that a supplement containing vitamins B6, B9, B12, and choline slowed glaucoma development and completely halted optic nerve damage. In mice.
In mice, that's always the caveat. But still promising. Do they know why?
They observed elevated homocysteine levels and reduced retinal vitamin utilization in glaucoma patients. Their hypothesis is that altered homocysteine indicates the retina's diminished ability to use necessary vitamins for healthy metabolism.
So are human trials happening?
Yes. A clinical trial for patients with primary open-angle and pseudo-exfoliation glaucoma is now underway. That's the critical next step.
Good. The article also briefly notes other health insights.
Yeah, a few quick hits. HIV drugs called NRTIs are linked to a substantially lower risk of Alzheimer's by preventing inflammasome activation that's a key inflammatory process.
Interesting connection.
SSRIs, the antidepressants, have been shown to reduce tumor size by over 50% and enhance cancer-fighting T cells in various cancer models. Again, early research, but intriguing.
Wow. Anything else?
Menthol-flavored cigarettes are linked to a higher risk of death from any cause, and specifically from cancer or cardiovascular disease. And exposure to high heat days is associated with accelerated biological aging.
Accelerated aging from heat.
Potentially adding up to 14 months of aging for those in consistently hot climates, according to the study cited.
Yikes. Okay, next, let's tackle a common concern for men. Fixture, erectile dysfunction.
Right, ED. It's a prevalent issue, affecting 52% of men aged 40 to 70, according to the article. It outlines various causes, which can help shed light on potential solutions.
And understanding the causes is key, right? What does it list?
Obesity is strongly linked, contributing to decreased testosterone and blood vessel damage. 79% of men with ED are reportedly overweight or obese.
Three times the risk for obese men.
Age is also a significant factor, with risk increasing about 10% each decade after 40. Lifestyle habits are huge too. Smoking, alcohol, illegal drugs, damage blood vessels, disrupt hormones, interfere with nerve signals. Smokers are 51% more likely to have ED.
And underlying health conditions.
Diabetes has the most significant impact, apparently. But heart disease, high blood pressure, multiple sclerosis, kidney disease also increase risk. Even certain medicines can have ED as a side effect.
So what's empowering here are the potential solutions outlined. Lifestyle changes first.
Paramount. Quitting smoking, losing weight, an average of 33 pounds loss, helped over 30% of men regain sexual function in one study cited, and maintaining a healthy diet. Fundamental steps.
What about supplements?
Certain supplements have shown promise, according to the article. DHEA, a hormone that helps produce testosterone, and L-arginine, an amino acid that produces nitric oxide to widen blood vessels. Both have shown benefits in some studies.
And if those initial steps aren't enough?
Then a medical intervention is available. A physician can perform tests, blood counts, testosterone levels, ultrasound, and prescribe oral medications like sildenafil, which is Viagra, or tadalafil, Cialis, or testosterone therapy if levels are low.
Adjusting existing medications or even implants are options too.
Yes, adjusting current meds that might be causing it, or even considering a penile implant are also options. It ensures a comprehensive and personalized approach, highlighting that there are many paths to finding a solution.
Good to know there are options. Finally, in the health section, we have Build Strong Bones for Life.
Right. This article emphasizes that bone health is absolutely fundamental for overall well-being and independence. Especially as nutritional deficiencies can quickly manifest in poor bone health, it's foundational for healthy aging.
And it highlights specific nutrients, what's key.
A crucial point that emerges here is the importance of what Newsmax calls the forgotten vitamin, vitamin K.
Vitamin K.
Often overshadowed by calcium and vitamin D, maybe, but it's vital for both bone and cardiovascular health. Its K2 form specifically helps direct calcium to bones, supporting density. Many older adults apparently lack sufficient vitamin K.
And vitamin D is still important.
Essential, of course. Though the article points out that sun exposure through windows doesn't count because the glass blocks the necessary ultraviolet light for production.
Good clarification. Other minerals.
Yes. Magnesium, strontium, silicon, zinc, and the trace mineral boron are also important. Boron apparently supports cardiovascular health and normal inflammatory response, too. Aquamin, a bioactive mineral source rich in calcium, is also mentioned for contributing to strong bones.
And bone loss is a concern for both men and women.
Yes. The Mayo Clinic notes menopause makes women particularly vulnerable, but men suffer from it, too. Adequate calcium and vitamin D as part of a balanced diet are crucial in reducing the risk of osteoporosis, which is a significant threat to maintaining independence later in life.
So these nutrients work together synergistically.
That's the message. The article mentions a specific product, Dr. David Brownstein's Caltrexin formula, designed to support bone and cardiovascular health by helping fill these nutritional gaps.
Economic and financial perspectives.
All right, moving into our economic and financial perspectives now, let's talk about something you might soon see at your local grocery store. Dynamic pricing.
Dynamic pricing.
Baby.
Like airline tickets.
Kind of. The Newsmax article, Grocery Store Where Prices Change 100 Times a Day, reports that in Norway, Rema 1000 grocery stores use electronic shelf labels to change prices up to 100 times a day.
100 times a day. Why?
Particularly during holidays, apparently, all to instantly match or beat competitors' prices.
That's a fascinating glimpse into the future of retail. Is it coming here?
It certainly seems so. Industry experts believe it's only a matter of time before dynamic pricing becomes common in American grocery stores. Retailers like Walmart, Kroger, Whole Foods are already using electronic labels, though maybe not changing prices that frequently yet.
And this prospect has raised some alarms.
Significant alarms among U.S. lawmakers and consumers. They fear surge pricing, where prices increase during busy shopping times or, say, adverse weather.
Like Uber surge pricing, but for milk.
Potentially. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bob Casey, for example, raised concerns that digital price tags could allow large grocery stores to squeeze consumers to increase profits. Social media has definitely seen angst over potential price jumps for party supplies during holidays or ice cream on hot days.
So how are retailers responding to these concerns? Are they embracing surge pricing?
Well, Kroger has stated it does not plan to use electronic tags for dynamic pricing, instead highlighting their role in freeing up staff and reducing paper waste.
Okay.
Wendy's faced backlash after announcing plans to test dynamic pricing, but then clarified they would offer discounts during slow periods, not price hikes during peak demand.
So trying to frame it positively.
Right. Target is implementing digital labels in nearly 190 U.S. stores, but states no intraday price changes are under consideration right now. So it shows a varied, cautious approach, likely driven by the potential for public backlash.
Interesting to see how that plays out. Moving from pricing to personal finances, the article Defend Your Data highlights a growing concern.
Data breaches, yeah, they seem constant.
This one mentions the recent national public data breach compromised Social Security numbers and other personal financial data of 2.9 billion people.
2.9 billion. That sounds impossibly large. Is that worldwide?
The article states it that way. It's a huge number regardless.
Yeah.
And what's particularly alarming is that many victims are unlikely to know they've been affected until it's too late. This follows other massive breaches like Equifax in 2017, Yahoo in 2013. It underscores the pervasive threat of identity theft.
It's a terrifying reality for so many. How does the article say identity theft typically happens?
Commonly through these data breaches, where large troves of personal information are just dumped on the dark web. But also, scammers exploit information from social media or public records to impersonate trusted entities, banks, government agencies, and trick individuals into revealing sensitive data. Phishing scams.
And what are the telltale signs?
Obvious signs include unexpected credit card or bank account charges, or suddenly getting a lot of unsolicited marketing for new credit. But more subtle indicators include unfamiliar inquiries on your credit report, or difficulty accessing your online accounts, unexpected password change notifications.
So vigilance is key.
Absolutely. The crucial takeaway is the necessity of regular monitoring of your credit reports from Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion.
To help you, our listener, protect yourself, what prevention steps does the article suggest?
Key steps include password protect all accounts, use a password manager for complex, unique passwords. Don't reuse passwords.
Good advice.
Avoid sharing your social security number or personal details unless absolutely necessary. Always double-check suspicious communications, log into official websites directly, verify senders independently. Never click unfamiliar links in emails or text.
And two-factor authentication.
Implement two-step or multi-factor authentication wherever possible. Collect your mail daily to prevent theft. For online shopping, ensure the website URL uses HTTPS. Basic but vital practices.
But what if you suspect identity theft has already occurred? What are the recovery steps?
It's crucial to act fast. First, file an identity theft report with the Federal Trade Commission, FTC.gov, and your local police. Set up banking alerts immediately. Change all your logins and passwords. Meticulously review your credit reports for any discrepancies and follow up with the credit reporting companies.
What about government IDs or SSN?
Report any lost or stolen government ID. If your Social Security number is compromised, contact the Social Security Administration and the IRS. Contact your bank to close any fraudulent accounts opened in your name. It's a daunting process, but these steps are vital.
Absolutely critical. Okay, shifting to investment and broader economic policy now. The big data section of Newsmax features a stark warning. The debt supercycle is ending.
Debt supercycle ending. What does that mean?
The article asserts that the current era of asset price inflation and financial bubbles, which they say was fueled by a massive increase in debt since the 2008 crisis, is finally coming to an end.
Sounds like a wake-up call for investors then.
Indeed. In this period of uncertainty, the message is clear. It's crucial for investors to protect and strategically position their assets, both for safety and for potential growth opportunities that might emerge.
And they recommend a resource.
Investment veteran David Skirica's book, Mega Returns, is presented as a guide offering specific strategies for navigating this challenging market, suggesting that a traditional buy-and-hold approach might not suffice anymore. It's about adapting.
What kind of topics does the book cover, according to the promo?
It covers several key themes reflecting this shifting landscape, things like investment-grade core debt, the next big short, the idea of the everything bubble, where nearly every asset class is seen as being at an all-time historical high, signaling an unsustainable situation.
So warnings about bubbles. Yeah. What else?
It also delves into the shifting back from financial to political power, suggesting a reordering of market drivers. And it highlights potential opportunities in areas like oil and gas, undervalued energy stocks, and new tech, the secret sources needed for the next AI.
So identifying potential growth areas too.
Right. But the urgency of the message is that the everything bubble will burst, and savvy investors must adapt their strategies now to avoid being, quote, whipped out.
Strong words. Finally, in our economic discussion, we have an article provocatively titled, Why the Fed Hates Republicans.
Ooh, that's a loaded title. What's the argument?
Newsmax contends that the Federal Reserve, under Chairman Jerome Powell, exhibits political inconsistency. That its commitment to fighting inflation versus expanding the economy seems to fluctuate based on which party occupies the White House. Republicans, specifically, allege that the Fed hates Republicans.
That's a powerful accusation. What's the basis for it?
Well, it highlights deep distrust. President Trump has accused Powell of being too late in cutting interest rates despite a flourishing economy during his term. He reportedly replaced a Biden appointee, Erica McIntyre, at the Bureau of Labor Statistics over what he called unreliable jobs numbers, expressing a desire for his own people to ensure transparency.
So, questioning the data and the Fed's motives, is there a historical pattern they point to?
The article highlights a pattern of interest rates that fuels these suspicions. During Trump's first term, from November 2016 to December 2018, Powell's Fed raised the prime rate 8 times.
Okay.
Then, while rates were slashed post-COVID-19 in March 2020, igniting inflation, Powell famously declared inflation transient in 2021, shortly after Joe Biden took office. He later blamed temporary supply bottlenecks.
And the political implication?
The article cites the cumulative 21% inflation under Biden as a major factor in voters turning to Trump in the 2024 election.
So how does this narrative continue into the current situation?
Despite cutting the benchmark interest rate three times in 2024, the Fed's priorities seemingly shifted again after Trump took office this time, with a renewed focus on inflation reportedly due to Trump's tariffs and a halting of economic expansion.
And critics agree with this assessment.
E.J. Antoni of the Heritage Foundation argues the Fed's models indicate a stronger case for rate cuts now than they did back in autumn 2024. Russ Vaught, former OMB director, criticizes Powell for being continually too late and observes that interest rates historically tend to be lower under Democrats, reinforcing the perception of political bias.
Are there direct allegations of political influence?
The article notes that President Obama first elevated Powell to the Federal Reserve Board in 2012, and Trump later nominated him as Fed chair in 2017, a decision Trump now clearly regrets, according to reports.
And campaign contributions.
Furthermore, OpenSecrets.org data is presented, revealing that a staggering 92.6% of political contributions from Fed employees in the 2024 cycle went to Democrats. This pattern, mirrored in other federal agencies, fuels suspicions of political bias within key government institutions. It raises a critical point about institutional impartiality and public trust in our economic drivers.
Around the states and cultural notes.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to around the states and cultural notes, starting with a quick tour of State of the States from Newsmax, highlighting some key regional developments.
All right, what's happening around the country?
In West Virginia, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the state can restrict access to abortion pills. Attorney General Patrick Morrissey hailed it as a big win and a pro-life victory. This just highlights the ongoing legal and political battles over reproductive rights state by state.
Definitely. What else?
Out west in Montana, nearly a dozen rivers in western Montana and parts of Yellowstone National Park have imposed fishing bans.
Fishing bans, why?
Due to meager flows and rising water temperatures, exceeding 77 degrees Fahrenheit, which can be lethal to trout, environmental stress indicators.
Oof, tough for the ecosystem and tourism, North Carolina.
Good news there, apparently. The state's first standalone children's hospital, a joint project by UNC Health and Duke Health, has been approved. A 500-bed facility expected to create 8,000 jobs.
That's a big development for the Research Triangle region, California.
Facing a jewel crisis, as we touched on earlier, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency due to severe drought and nitrate contamination. 150 communities experiencing drinking water nitrate levels above acceptable standards. Critical infrastructure and environmental challenges.
Arkansas.
Attorney General Tim Griffin criticized municipalities for not enforcing the state's anti-loitering law to curb unsafe panhandling, urging greater action from local officials, a local enforcement issue.
Florida. Always something happening there.
Governor Ron DeSantis announced the commencement of deportation flights from the Alligator Alcatraz immigration lockup in the Everglades, transferring hundreds of detainees. The White House reportedly views the facility's remoteness as a deterrent.
Alligator Alcatraz. And President Trump is considering reopening the actual Alcatraz.
Apparently so. Considering reopening Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay to house illegal immigrants, according to the article.
Wow, Minnesota.
A juvenile sentencing law signed by Democrat Governor Tim Walz led to the release of David Brom, now 53. He had murdered his parents and siblings when he was 16.
Why was he released?
The law abolished life sentences without early release for juvenile offenders, a move opposed by Republican legislators. Highly controversial.
And Iowa. A happier note.
A much happier note. Nash Keene, a baby born at only 21 weeks gestation, 133 days early, weighing just 10 ounces, celebrated his first birthday and received a Guinness World Record for being the most premature baby to survive, highlighting advances in life-saving treatment.
Amazing story of survival.
Mm.
Okay, moving from state-specific news to broader urban challenges, the Newsmax issue includes new chapter for homeless.
Right. The article reports the Trump administration is initiating a pivotal policy shift away from housing first.
Housing first. That's the model focused on getting people housed immediately, right?
Yes, which Newsmax describes as the federal government's one-size-fits-all and failed approach to homelessness. Strong words.
What's their critique of the housing first model?
They argue it provided lifelong, subsidized housing without requiring individuals to address underlying challenges, addiction, mental illness, trauma. The theory was housing would be a springboard for recovery.
But Newsmax says it didn't work.
The reality, according to the article, is that since its institutionalization, homelessness has surged by 34%, reaching nearly 275,000 unsheltered people in 2024, the highest number ever recorded.
So what did it call its fatal flaw?
The denial of the complexities driving homelessness and the stipulation that no treatment can be required. They point out that many homeless clients, 77%, struggle with addiction and 60% with mental illness.
So the new direction is?
The article suggests the Trump administration will focus on an approach that brings structure, recovery, and hope, implying a shift towards addressing these underlying issues alongside housing provision.
So a more comprehensive, perhaps more demanding approach, emphasizing accountability and long-term solutions over just shelter.
That seems to be the direction indicated. Finally, we turn to some cultural notes and controversial figures. Ben Stein's column, Dreamsy, and another article, Why Epstein Won't Die, both ponder the enduring mysteries surrounding Jeffrey Epstein.
Epstein, yeah, those questions linger.
From his sudden wealth as a former junior high teacher to his controversial death, highlighting a continued public demand for transparency that remains largely unfulfilled.
Stein specifically questions Epstein's mysterious rise, right?
Yeah. How did a former teacher earning a modest sum become an apparent billionaire within a decade? Acquiring a private jet, lavish homes, that private Caribbean island used for underage sex, without any clear, legitimate source of wealth. Stein, an expert in financial fraud himself, notes the stark contrast with his own experience.
Underscoring how extraordinary Epstein's fortune seemed. And then there's the pervasive death controversy.
His suicide in a Manhattan jail cell, despite claims of constant surveillance. It remains a central mystery for many. The official cause was suicide, but neck fractures were reportedly more indicative of homicidal strangulation, according to some reports mentioned.
And the public reaction, especially among Trump supporters.
The MAGA faithful expected radical transparency under Trump, Newsmax says, but were met with shock and disbelief over the official story of malfunctioning cameras, sleeping guards, his cellmate being moved.
Even though some figures like Kash Patel and Dan Bongino publicly stated he killed himself.
For many, it still felt like a whitewash, according to the article.
The timeline of events and the perceived lack of transparency are particularly frustrating for people.
Absolutely. Epstein's 2007 arrest for soliciting prostitution led to that plea deal brokered by Acosta, who later became Trump's labor secretary. Victims, including Virginia Giuffre, fought to void his non-prosecution agreement.
Giuffre, who alleged being a sex slave and implicated Prince Andrew. She reportedly died by suicide this year.
Yes, at age 41, though her father suspected foul play, according to the report. Then Epstein was arrested again in 2019 on federal sex trafficking charges. Details about high-profile men on his Lolita Express emerged, but he died in jail.
And the client list.
In February 2025, AG Pam Bondi hinted at seeing a client list. But on July 7, 2025, the DOJ stated Epstein did not maintain such a list and would not release more files. An FBI DOJ report supported suicide based on surveillance video, further compounding the sense of unanswered questions for many.
And this deep dive into Epstein's background, it reveals his rapid ascent.
From high school teacher to Bear Stearns, founding his own firm, advising billionaires like Leslie Wexner, creating a nonprofit donating to places like Harvard. These connections only deepen the mystery around his wealth and influence for some.
Any notable quotes?
Conservative consultant Roger Stone commented, "Trump was supposed to be the bull in the china shop. If you can't have transparency, it's a disgrace." The article underscores a persistent public perception that someone should be held accountable and it seems no one cares, highlighting a profound crisis of trust.
A complex and disturbing story with few clear answers. Finally, a little media commentary.
Yes, Bill O'Reilly's Talking Points column, titled Colbert Canceled. O'Reilly references the cancellation of Stephen Colbert, implying a shifting media landscape where strong political stances can have significant consequences.
And O'Reilly reflects on his own experiences.
Yes, recalling legendary debates with David Letterman, who, despite being cranky, didn't display rank hatred and had him on 16 times. Jay Leno was described as non-political. Jimmy Fallon as someone who understands the business.
Contrasting that with today's environment.
Exactly. Contrasting it sharply with an implied more polarized and unforgiving environment that O'Reilly suggests led to Colbert's situation, painting a picture of a media world increasingly less tolerant of dissenting or even strong political viewpoints from his perspective. Okay, let's unpack all of this. We've journeyed through a truly remarkable landscape in the September 2025 issue of Newsmax magazine.
Whew! Quite a journey from the Trump administration's sweeping reforms in healthcare and that ambitious vision for a Golden Dome missile defense shield.
To the profound concerns over AI's left-wing bias, according to the articles, and its potential threats to humanity.
Indeed. We've seen how deeply interconnected these issues are presented as being. Political strategies shaping Medicaid, economic migration redrawing state lines.
And cultural shifts sparking intense debates over everything from, you know, e-bike safety to the very fabric of national identity.
One key takeaway, I think, is the consistent thread of trying to discern truth and navigate information overload in an increasingly complex world, especially where even AI can inherit biases.
We even delved into the ongoing mysteries surrounding figures like Jeffrey Epstein, highlighting that persistent demand for transparency in an era where trust in institutions is constantly being tested.
It's clear that whether we're talking about global nuclear alliances or the prices at our local grocery store, the implications presented are far-reaching and touch pretty much every aspect of our lives.
This compels us to ask an important question for you, the listener. In a world where information sources themselves, as Newsmax points out with AI, have declared or inherent biases, and digital prices might change by the minute,
how do you cultivate a personal sense of truth and value in your own lives? And what responsibility do you feel you have to seek perspectives beyond your chosen echo chambers? What truly stands out to you from this deep dive, and what will you explore next?
We hope this deep dive into Newsmax for September 2025 has given you plenty to think about. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep digging deeper.
Absolutely. Goodbye for now.